0818 715 815.
Hello, good afternoon. You are very welcome to Liveline. Katie Hannan with you until 3 o'clock this Friday. And before I go to my first call, I just want to say I think we're all a bit knocked sideways by that farewell goodbye from Brian Dobson. Dobbo has left the building. A beautiful sign-off after the most extraordinary career. I mean, what a legend. 37 years. I just can't imagine a state visit or a state funeral or an election without Brian Dobson in the centre of it. I mean, are you even elected if Brian Dobson doesn't say that you're over the quota? All of us in Liveline here just want to wish him the very, very best in the next chapter. I'm sure it will be an interesting one because he is a man that, honestly, you would travel very, very far to find anyone with a bad word to say about him. He will be sorely missed around these parts, and I'm sure around all parts around the country. And I'm sure you'll join with us in wishing the legend well. OK, let me get on to our first call then. Gail. Gail, good afternoon.
Hello, how are you, Katie?
Gail, we were talking, I mean, the country is talking about this actually today. The sale of RIP.ie, I think it really jolted people a little bit this morning because so many people rely on RIP.ie for obviously to find out if who's dead, as in the famous country question, who's dead, but also, you know, to check out, you know, who's related to who, where, you know, where are events, you know, where are funerals happening, all of that. But you have another really important reason for being interested in RIP.ie, Gail.
I do. I'm an amateur genealogist and I trace as a hobby. And I'm convinced that, you know, in years to come and even currently, that RIP will be as important to genealogy as the census. And we rely very heavily on the census as it stands. But the amount of information that RIP are capturing for future genealogists and for current, it's that we've had nothing like it before. So I've used it tracing within my own family, but I suppose in the last month I had another experience. I was up in Mother Jones's Market in Cork, and I'm from Tralee, and I was up for the day, and I was browsing around, and there was a box of loose black and white photographs, and I found a communion photograph of a girl, and it was from around the 1930s, judging by the style of her dress. And my first thought was, my goodness, that's a very special photograph to a family. What's it doing loose in a box here? And then also maybe that it's really expensive to take a photograph back in the 1930s. This was a big deal to have this photograph taken. And now it's ended up with these random photographs. So I turned it over and a big surprise, her name and address was on the back.
Oh, brilliant.
On the back of the photograph. Now, I won't use the name and address just for the family's privacy.
I don't, of course, yeah.
The address was in Dublin. So okay. The photograph was in a box of loose photographs in Cork, and I could see that she came from Dublin. Now, her name and address was written in very, very faint pencil, and you could see that it was a child's writing. She had written it herself, and you could see that she had practiced her signature underneath it as well. So I had her name, and I said, I have to get this back to the family. So I bought it for a fiver. And in genealogy, when I'm tracing, I generally start with the death notices in the newspaper archives. And that really is what RIP has become. It's become that and more. And I looked at the age of the style of the dress. 1930s, I thought, OK, I'm going to try RIP.ie first of all. So I had the girl's first name. And I had her maiden name. I didn't know if she had ever got married. So when you're doing the searches, as everybody knows, all our users of RIP.ie, there is a knee option. So I put in her first name and I put in her maiden name in the knee option. And I did a search back as far as 2008. You can do the search. You can open it up back as far as 2008.
I know it's searchable to that degree for the knee option.
Back as far as 2008. So I found a number of people going with the same name, with the same maiden name. So I went into them. There was about six or seven of them. And I found the other thing that's very handy, the other thing that RIP are capturing is that they'll have your previous address. So, you know, if you move to Dublin, to join the civil service and move to Dublin, they might say, you know, late of truly. So you're getting the connection back to the home place.
Yes, so I think that's actually hugely, just quite apart from what you're trying to do there. It's a hugely important thing for people wondering, oh, is that the McGee that I went to school with, or is that the, you know, the person that I think from, you know, my home place? So that's hugely important, I think, for people who use RIP.ie just to see who's dead. But anyway, go on.
It is because if and they put it in various counties. Say you're working in Dublin, and they post it in your home county as well, so you're not going to miss anybody's death. So I found her by her old address. And within the details on RIP, then, of course, there was the name of her children and her siblings. And so I searched then for those names, and I had no joy. So I returned again to RIP, and I had the names of the siblings. So I put the names of the siblings into RIP.ie, and I got another record came up. One of her sisters had passed away. And when her sister had passed away, the condolences were in use. And the condolences have really taken off now since COVID. You can see that they weren't in as much use pre-COVID, but since COVID, when we couldn't go to pay our respects, putting in condolences, you can see that that's just taken off. So within the condolences, I found a sympathy from a grandniece. She had mentioned that she was a grandniece, and she had an unusual name. So I found her, I traced her then on Facebook because of her unusual name, and I was able to find her. She was living in Ireland, and I sent her a DM and I asked if she could help me make contact with the family, and I sent her a copy of the photographs. So she said, leave it with her. And the next day I got a telephone call from a daughter of the woman in the photograph.
Oh my God.
And she'd never seen that photograph of her mother before. Communion photograph.
Priceless, absolutely priceless. And Gail, can I just say, you have missed your calling as a private investigator, clearly.
Well, you know, if you're a genealogist, you just have, you know, it's tenacity. You have to, if you can't find the information one way, there's a few other ways you can go, but you just have to keep going. There's always an angle to find a family link. So I spoke with her daughter, and she was thrilled to see this photograph.
Oh, I'm sure she was. These are so special. I mean, this is as I say, literally priceless.
Well, it wouldn't have been possible without RIP. Absolutely wouldn't. Because if you look back, if I had found that information via census, I wouldn't have had the condolence drop-down option and been able to make the connection with the family. So in years to come, and I hope now, you know, now that it's sold, that all of that will be taken into consideration, its importance going forward, and the archiving of all of these links. Because, okay, in 100 years' time, somebody will be tracing, and they'll be using RIP as the resource.
That's a very important point, actually, and I wonder, have the Irish Times taken that into consideration in the purchase of this? Because I would imagine it's quite a lucrative platform to potentially for, you know, if you wanted to monetize what's going on here. But in terms of the responsibility that would come with that, if you are the keeper now of, as you say, all this hugely important archive.
Yeah, well, I noticed that actually. I read the press release from the original owners of RIP, and they mentioned specifically that, you know, they were trusting their archive. So it is a hugely important, I suppose, there's a huge amount of personal information in it, and that's the type of personal information we don't get maybe for 100 years. When the census aren't released for 100 years, that's a long time to wait to try to trace a family. So RIP and the old newspaper death notices are so important to people tracing at the moment, in tracing families in more recent years.
Yeah, I just see Jay Coleman. That was the part of the couple who owned and who built RIP.ie up from nothing. That was Jay and Dimpna Coleman. And he's quoted today in the Irish Times as saying, "We're immensely proud of what RIP.ie has become and what it means to the people of Ireland." And it does, I think, mean an awful lot to the people of Ireland. He says, "In the Irish Times, we believe we have found a worthy custodian, one that will allow the site to grow and continue to offer a familiar and trusted resource for end of life matters." Gail, will you hang on for me? I've got Sean
Thank
on.
You.
Thanks, Gail. It's a great story and fair play to you and well done. And I'm sure that family are really, really grateful for you returning that photo, for that fiver that you invested in their memory. It's a really lovely story. Sean, good afternoon.
How are you doing?
Yeah, Sean, you're funeral director.
Yeah, that's correct, yeah.
Up there in the Inishowen Peninsula, is that right?
Yes, up in Inishowen, yeah.
Sean, what did you think when you opened your paper this morning and heard this news?
I was actually shocked. I was very shocked and surprised by it.
Tell me, how has RIP.ie changed how you go about putting in funeral notices?
That's made life very easy for us. It's only a matter of me logging in to our account. We have our own account at Funeral Directors. And within 5 minutes, we can have the obituary up online.
And tell me, am I right in saying you have to be a funeral director? You have to be kind of a registered...
You have to be registered.
We're struggling a little bit with your line there, Sean.
Yes,
well, hopefully we'll stick it out. We'll hang on a minute and maybe it might sort itself out for us. And do you have to pay a fee to put a death notice online?
No, a death notice is actually free. But if we put our name to the death notice, it's around 980 per death notice. So if we put in a death notice and we say it's care of an Inishowen funeral service, that will be 980 the funeral director's charged. But if we don't put our name to it, it's free.
Oh, right, OK. But do you normally put your name to it? Because it's good advertising for
yourselves. We normally put our name to it because it just means then people know who's doing the funerals and can, if they want to find out any more information, they can contact us then as well.
OK. And is that... because I'm sure the newspaper's always charged for death notices.
Yeah, newspapers charge. They have a fee, set fee as well. Local radio stations that does it, they have a set fee as well.
And what kind of fees are we talking about there?
Well, local radio, you're chatting around 150.
150 euro per death notice.
That'll be read out three times and it'll be read out for 3 days.
That's up there in Highland Radio, is it?
Highland Radio, yeah.
And I presume it's similar because I know for a fact that certainly in Kerry Radio, the death notices were one of the most popular parts of the radio schedule throughout the day. You definitely would make sure you'd be listening for...
Everything has to stop.
Everything has to stop, exactly. So 150 for that. And then what about the newspapers?
Newspapers can range from 50 euro to 100 euro for death notice.
50 to 100.
Yeah.
And I heard this morning another funeral director talking about 500 euro. Is that...
Yeah, well, if you go to the national papers, you're chatting and the way they work... It's per word. So the more words you've had for the death notice, it'll be actually dear. So you're chatting in around that region for a death notice and say an Irish Times or something like that there.
You could pay up to 500 euro for an Irish Times death notice.
It all depends what way you word it.
You could imagine that some of the lesser relatives might be dropped off the end of the bereaved list.
Well, that's it.
to save a few quid in some circumstances. And that's one thing I did notice, actually. The RIP.ie death notices are more lengthy, maybe, than you might be used to seeing in the newspapers. Would I be right in that?
Exactly. Like, you can let the people know who the families were, loving sons or daughters or brothers or sisters, whereas if you put a death notice on, say, like the local radio, they're not going to name that person's loved ones. You know, it'll just be the person that's deceased.
What do you think it is about our fascination with this, Sean? Because apparently there's 60 million hits a month on this website, which is extraordinary.
It's extraordinary. Look, the way things have gone, people want to know. People like social media and everything, people want to know. It's just a fascination. I think people just, they're such a person's dead, you know. Well, they wouldn't have heard these things.
And Do you think, I mean, you said you were shocked when you heard this news this morning. Now, what would you be worried about in terms of what might happen with RIP.ie with new owners?
Well, when I was told straight away about it, the first thing came into my head, they're going to charge.
Yeah.
That's another expense on the family.
Now, charge for putting in a death notice rather
death
than charge
notice,
people
yes.
to look at death notices, that would be.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, I'd be charging the family. No, but I do know that some of these websites will be other businesses like Headstones and Forest. They'll be charged for advertising on them sites.
Yeah, but
they actually do that at the moment, don't they?
I was just going to say, I'm sure there is there's paid for advertising for funeral related activities on anyway. So and that presumably is how they've monetized the site up to now.
Yeah.
But as well as that, whatever, that 10 or that 9 something that you can
you're
asked for if your name goes on it. But you're saying that you think they might, that they'll, I mean, to be honest, I'm kind of astonished that they haven't been charging all along.
I think down the road that's going to be a set fee.
Right.
Obviously, when a company like that comes on. Now, I could be wrong, and hopefully I am wrong.
But given that they provide a very valuable service, would you begrudge them a payment?
Grieving, people will be grieving. They'll want it on, and they'll not care what it costs.
No.
But at the end of the day, if they want it on, it will not matter what the cost is.
That's true. Will you hang on, Sean? And we might try and fix your line a bit because it is.
I'm just in a bad area. Just.
Yeah, well, it mightn't be fixable then. We'll see if we can do anything with it. Please don't go away because I'm really interested in what you're saying about this. And you're the man in the front line of this. But can I'll bring in Joe for a moment. Joe, good afternoon.
Afternoon, Katie.
Now, you're a regular RIP.ie user, I believe.
I think this is, it's the most fantastic website that is available there, and it's available gratis. All right, the people who their family die, they have to pay for it there, but I find it a fantastic tool there. I was in politics for many years, but I use it to keep an eye on people, because the great thing, and people don't realise it, you may not realise it, Katie, but if you want to find out we're in County Mayo. If you want to find out if somebody in County Mayo died in County Kerry, if you go into County Kerry, whatever, it will show up Mayo as well. You know, but in County Roscommon, it will show up your own town, County Sligo, County Galway. So it's a fantastic tool to say, well, from people who may have gone away years ago, and I'm talking to somebody that would go to probably about 40 funerals a year for the last 50 years.
Yourself?
Do the maths.
You're saying you would have done, you do about 40 funerals a year?
Easily, yeah.
That'd be
I've been doing it for 40 years. Sorry?
Not quite a funeral a week, but getting close to it.
Well, outside, we have a pub as well in Swinford Mellets Emporium, and there's hardly a week goes by that there isn't a funeral goes by. So that's 50 for the year type of thing, you know. So it's one of the facts of life there. But what I'm saying there is that
do you know what though? I'm going to say one thing now that I find that people in Dublin do not have the same inclination to go to funerals as people from the west of Ireland anyway, or down the country. Would that be the case?
Yeah, you're right, Sean. The Irish are unique. I cannot understand how English people take death so lightly, but we take it hammer and tongs, and we mourn with the people, and it can go on for days, and we comfort them, because an awful lot of people die who don't have close relatives and that. So it's very, very important as a medium for, as the fellow says, support to be the word, I suppose, that you use stronger than ever, you know.
Yeah, it is. And it's also, I mean, let's be frank as well, it's a social outlet and it's a way to catch up with people in some cases.
People don't talk anymore, so it's the one medium there is that there was a time there long before Midwest Radio and all the local stations there where if somebody died, then the phones would be ringing with, did you hear Katie or Joe or something was dead? That has all stopped. It's assumed that you're listening to Midwest Radio and RIP.ie or all the other stations there. Assumed like that. And assumed is a word that you have to be very careful of. But that's the reality there. If you want to know what's going on, you've got to tune into your local radio station, or RIP.
Or RT. but the, Joe, how often would you check RIP.ie?
About 10 times a week.
More than once a day?
Maybe more. More than once a day, yeah.
So you are, now I'm getting a picture of why we get 60 million hits on this website. And why would you think, okay, that, would you be that anxious to be sure not to miss a death?
I would be extremely, extremely anxious. As an awful lot of my neighbours and friends and that are the same way. It's a culture there, and we support each other in good times, but more importantly in bad times. So if there's a funeral of somebody who died in 40 miles away there and they were from Swinford, I certainly, if I couldn't go, I would send a message of condolence. And the condolence is it's the easy way out, but better still if you can go to the funeral. But I would take it personally that people should be assured that we're thinking of them in their times of grief.
There is a sort of a status thing. There's the full on is the removal and the wake, the removal and the funeral mass. And then the next level down might be the removal and the funeral mass. Then there is just the funeral mass. And then there is just the condolence on RIP.ie. Would that be the sliding scale of sympathy?
Sympathy there. And the wake is coming back more and more where you would stay up with the corpse all the night before. It's not brought to the church anymore the night before as it used to be there. It's kind of stay all night in the house and bring it from the house to the church and then on to the cemetery or the crematorium or whatever the next day, you know. So it's look at, there's no point in being saying something funny, but it's a good funeral is a very, very important thing to have for the family. Extremely important.
There is no doubt about that. And it's the thing that will be remembered for a long time as well. Right. And it gives a comfort in a way that you actually can't put words on. Will you hang on, Joe? I'm told that Sean is on his way to a funeral. So I have to let him go. Sean, do we have you back there?
Yeah, I'm back, yeah.
Yeah, Sean, I don't want to keep you if you have important business there. But overall, what would you be saying to the good people in the Irish Times in terms of how they should manage this very important website now?
I would just love to just keep it the way it's going. Just keep it as it is.
What Joe was saying there about, you know, he'd be a 40 funeral a year kind of man. Again, Donegal, funerals are hugely, hugely important parts of the community, aren't they?
Yeah, most definitely.
Has it changed in recent years?
No, not up here now. We're just still the same. Wake two nights in the house and funeral after 3 days, just more or less. That's how it's always been the same up here.
And would you have the same kind of crowds coming? Would it be as big an event, you know, as maybe 10, 20 years ago?
Much the same.
So the condolences hasn't, you know, that hasn't been a sort of an easy way out for people. People are still making the effort and going to sympathise with the family in person.
No, definitely not.
Okay. Sean, listen, I let you go because I appreciate you gave us your time when you were on your way to important business. But thank you for that. I want to hang on. Joe, please hang on. And Gail, hang on. We'll have more calls on this after this.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815. Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
And we're talking about the sale of RIP.ie to the Irish Times, which was announced this morning. Can I bring in Brian now? Brian, good afternoon.
Hi, Katie.
What did you think when you saw that news?
Well, I saw the news yesterday even, and I said to myself, that's the end of free RIP.ie. You know, I've subscribed to this for many, many years, I guess. Notifications 3 times a day now. It used to be 4 at one stage, but that was all changed a couple of months back for whatever reasons. Like, it was 9 a.m., 12 noon, 3 p.m., and 6 p.m. They were, you know, the hours that, you know, I got notifications through email every day. But
and what would you get? Because what notifications would you get? Any updates? Any more deaths that had...
It tells you every few hours, like, and they're all different deaths. So it's not the same ones as that were in the previous notifications.
So all the fresh notices basically get updated every few hours, and you and that would ping in your emails every few hours then.
Yeah. Well, you know, my friends laugh at me, but, you know, the whole point of me kind of being on there and checking all these things is to be ahead of the posse, just to make sure my own name is not on there before they get another, you know?
I was going to say, so every time when you hear that ping, you go, oh, who's dead now?
Yeah. Oh, I do. And the thing is, you know, if it's people we know or my, you know, friends, a friend or family would know, I will actually send them on the notifications, you know?
Okay, so you are now the oracle of because I think every family has that one person actually who keeps an eye on all this stuff and lets everyone else know.
Yeah,
and they are probably underappreciated, to be honest, because it is very important, because you do not want to be serious for a minute. You don't want to miss.
If
somebody you know has been bereaved and you would want to send your sympathies, you don't want to miss it, because that is really really horrible.
Katie, I've had chronic health problems for years, and I'm mainly housebound when I'm not in hospital bed. So the thing is, to me, like, I can see all this happening because I'm not out in the public domain, and I can't hear or be told what's going on out there, you know.
Mm-hmm. So it's kind of a bit of an interest for you.
Yes, very much so. Yeah.
And the other thing, you find out so much more than just somebody has passed, because you're reminded of, oh yeah, they're related to so and so, and I forgot, yeah, they originally came out of that place. Oh no, sure, wasn't she the, you know, originally her maiden name was that? Like, there is actually an enormous amount of information just from one death notice.
I look at the last hour.
Yeah.
Sorry, last month, and there was three good clients of mine over the years who all died. Well, in the month of April, you know.
My God, what business are you in, Brian? Do you mind me asking?
I'm in a photographic retail in City Centre.
Oh right, okay. So these are people that would have been into you for photographs.
Cameras,
yeah, of course. Just, and you say there, that's it, that's the free service gone.
Yeah.
In what way? Do you mean that they'll charge for the notices, or they'll charge for you to check the notices?
Yeah, well, they'll certainly, like, for each time we get a notification, we're probably going to have to pay for it, or they might charge you on it, on, you know, even initially, maybe only a couple of euros on a daily basis. I don't know how many subscribers they have, but, you know, let's face it, I'm just going to pick a figure, say, of 50,000. So 2 euros a day is 100,000 a day. That's nice business, you know.
Well, just to say, the Irish Times have put out a statement. I'm looking at it here now. And obviously they knew people would be wondering about that. And just one line of this, it said, the acquisition helps us in our mission to stay relevant to our audiences. And it says, with RIP.ie, we will continue to provide a free-to-view, reliable and valued service to Irish communities. So they're committing themselves there to continuing to provide the service free to view. So that's promising, no? Mm-hmm.
Oh yeah, absolutely. That's what they're telling you now. I mean, and in a few hours' time, it'll all have changed. Like, it's a bit like our politicians and TDs. I mean, same thing there. They say one thing before they're elected, and directly after they're elected, it's tough luck. No, that's not what I meant, you know.
Well, that's it. And I mean, again, Jay Coleman, who sold it to them, also talks about the Irish Times being a worthy custodian of their platform. Mm-hmm. Well, we have to take them.
I would agree with that. You know, I say I've been a subscriber and reader for many, 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 many years of the Irish Times. Yeah. And I enjoy very much reading it.
Yes. So the Irish, would you, like what I'm saying, what Jay Coleman was saying is that they built this up from nothing, obviously, from day one.
Yeah,
and
correct.
They feel they've handed it on to a good custodian, somebody who will look after it for them.
I wouldn't disagree with that in the least. I wouldn't disagree. All I'm saying is, you know, how much is it going to cost in a number of hours, days, weeks, or whatever, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I know, because we've all seen where these sites are monetized one way or another. But hang on there, Brian. Yeah. I want to bring in Gail before I let you go, Gail. How are
you?
Would you pay for it if they did start charging for, you know, maybe for searches or for access on some level?
Well, I'm a member of a number of different archives. So really the RIP will be a similar archive. And you're talking about monetizing down the line. You can see that on the various genealogical sites that they do charge for access to those services. Now, maybe not in real time now, but going back a number of years. So in years to come, you could potentially see that that might be where the information would go. But I would hope that the National Archives of Ireland would be in discussion either with the previous owners or with the Irish Times to hold that archive for going forward for people. But I would pay, yes.
That's a very good point, actually. Is this something that the National Archives... Because maintaining an archive is actually a very expensive business. It's not, you can't just let it sitting there. It has to, you know, it does actually cost, because there was that big row some years ago that the Sunday Tribune archive, a very, very valuable archive, that was dismantled basically. And to my mind, a huge loss in terms of archival information going back decades. Maybe it is something that the National Archive should be taking an interest in, because as you say, it's the kind of information that's not, it's not held anywhere else.
Well, one of your callers there mentioned you get the names of the siblings, you get the married names of the children, you're getting within such a small notice is a wealth of information. So yeah, it does need to be preserved.
It needs to be preserved. And Joe, I'll give you the last word on it. What is...
Hi, Katie.
Yeah, Joe. What do you think is the best part about RIP.ie?
You know, I think there's an opportunity here now for the Irish Times in publishing this, and I'd certainly keep that tape where they said there's going to be no increase in charges, but there's an opportunity for them to publish those death notices that they will have on RIP in the daily paper, included in the paper, and I think it will be very, very of huge monetary value to them, because people will buy the paper. Because any time that there's ever a death and it's published in the papers, and I know it from being a former news agent, families will buy scores of papers. So I think there's an opportunity there for the Times to do that. Let things stand as they are, but publish it in the papers for the same, for no extra cost to the poor families.
So people do that, do they? So they'll always have that written record, the time that their father, their mother, whatever, actually had their death notes in the paper, and they have copies of that for everyone.
They love it, because remember, when it's up to €500 to put a death notice in the daily papers, it's too prohibitive, it's too expensive. I always thought that the papers, they should publish those death notices gratis, and they would see a serious increase in their sales, because they're dropping day by day. So it's just a suggestion there. Let's see what happens there. But I certainly won't be subscribing to something that's current. I pay a fee to Find My Past and those other genealogical sites there, but certainly not for something current. And I don't want to stop going to funerals.
Right. Joe, I don't think there's any danger of that with your record. Joe, thanks
very
much.
You ring me. Thanks, Katie. Right,
okay, thanks, Joe. Yeah, appreciate that. Thanks, Brian. Thanks, Gail. We'll take a break.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815. Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
And if any of you were listening there to Brian Dobson's last moments on air before he signed off for his retirement, and we were talking about what an extraordinary contribution he has made to Irish public life. Marion, he also made an extraordinary contribution to your family life.
He absolutely did, Katie. When my son was only very, very small, and he would refuse to go to bed until Brian Dobson came on the television. So there would be blue monitor if we tried to put him any earlier to bed. So
This is when he was on the 9 o'clock news.
Yes. So I'm not sure if it was the news he was waiting for, or, you know, his way of staying up until at least 9 o'clock. So,
and this is when he was a toddler, was it?
Yes. Now, he used to call him Brian Dobson, so he was quite young. So he was obviously a very discerning viewer, even at that age.
I I don't know, did Brian realise some of his fan base was that young indeed at that stage? So, Boyne Dobson.
That's it.
What age is your son now, Marion?
Oh my God, he's in his 30s and he's absolutely killed me. If he knew what he did.
He's going to say, he's not going to love this on the national airwaves, is he? But maybe he
luckily
was...
for me, he's not a radio fan.
Okay. We won't tell him about it. Listen, Marion, thanks so much for calling in with that. And I'm sure if Brian is out there or somebody will pass it on to him. Just one more contribution to Irish life that he didn't know he was making. Marion, thanks for that. Marion's gone there. We'll bring in Gail. Now, yesterday we had an extraordinary story about this the theft of a painting from the Tate Gallery in London. And the reason it was being stolen was because these were paintings that had been loaned or given or left with the Tate in London by Hugh Lane because there was no home for them in Ireland at that point. But the student who stole them felt that they was rightly belonged to the Irish people, that they should be back in Ireland in the Hugh Lane Gallery as is now. And he walked into the Tate Gallery, walked out the door with the painting under his arm and caused quite the international stir at the time. And this kicked off a debate and a discussion on our programme and indeed online afterwards when we came off air about all the other artefacts that people think we should have here and should be brought home. So, Gail, what is over there that should be over here?
It's called a blend.
Oh, do you know what, Gail? That is not a great line now. Will we see if we can fix that with Gail? But don't worry, because there is a lot of artefacts and we have a lot of callers who want to tell us about them. Michael, are you there? OK, now I start to worry if we don't have Michael either. Do we have Michael on that line? Will we try for Moira?
Hi, Katie. How
oh,
are
good
you?
Woman yourself, Moira. I was getting worried. Oh, my God. Are you from Swinford as well, Moira?
I am, yes. I heard Joe on there just a few minutes ago.
I was going to say, that's an extraordinary coincidence. Yes. So tell us, the Swinford Torque, is that another Torque?
It is. Now, it wouldn't be as big as the Blessington Lunula. I've been practicing saying that word. It is basically, it's like a ribbon of gold that was twisted and it was tied at the back with hooks and the Swinford Torque would have been worn around the neck. And it was discovered in October 1868 by a group apparently cutting turf. And eventually, we don't know how it left Swinford, but it ended up in Derry. And from there, it was sold to the British Museum in 1873.
It was sold to the British Museum?
Yeah, or I suppose they purchased it.
Right.
Yeah.
And it was. Do we know who found it originally in Swinford?
No, the name is not known. We have researched that, but we haven't found who the actual person was. In 2019, Katie, Swinford was 250 years old, and we were putting a little historical booklet together, and we discovered the Swinford Torque. And one of the group was in London, and she went to the British Museum. This is Maura Sweeney. Mm-hmm. And she thought she might be able to get to see it, but unfortunately, it wasn't on show. And she just inquired about what were the chances of us getting to have it over here in Mayo. And it is a process. It takes, I think, arrangements take about a year, Katie.
All right.
And it would have to be in association with our National Museum here, mm-hmm. and possibly the Mayo County Council.
I'm actually looking at a photograph of it now, Moira, as I'm talking to you. Oh, it's a really beautiful thing, actually, isn't it? It's quite modern looking, funnily enough. It looks like something that could be fashioned by a goldsmith today. It's really beautiful. They're saying they found it. It was found by a group cutting turf at a depth of 2 metres.
And it would be in a village outside of Swinford, Katie, like just about 2 to 3 miles outside of Swinford.
It's generally accepted. I was going to ask you how old it is, but it's generally accepted because there apparently there's debate about how to date these torques. It's generally accepted that they date either from the Middle Bronze Age, so that's 2300 BC, or the Iron Age, going right back. Wow.
Yeah.
So, where did it go after that? After the inquiry was made, was there any effort made to bring it back or to arrange that? Or,
well, unfortunately, COVID happened at the time. But we have been discussing about it lately again, and I suppose after hearing on Liveline yesterday, it's probably kick-started us in our mind to start getting this organised, because it does take a while. And we have the National Museum of Country Life here in Thurdock in Mayo, which it could be displayed there, and it obviously would have the security and everything that probably this kind of item would require.
Yeah, it would be lovely to get it back. Do we have Piers Brosnan? Because he threw his weight behind this campaign to bring those paintings home. And sure, we could throw a few torques into that as well. Have we got Piers? What Piers had to say about this?
Really, let's hear enough it. Is enough now. Bring them back home. It would be rude not to. I'll have to put my thinking hat on here, you know. Thomas Crown, too.
Enough is enough. Bring them back home. It would be rude not to. So that's our campaign. Hashtag, it would be rude not to. Myra, thanks for that. Let me bring in Gail. Do we have Gail back on the line?
Hi, Katie. When I was in London last August, my son, we were in the museum there, and my son we were just looking along and saw Blessington. So, of course, that piqued our interest. And this gold lunula, I think is how you pronounce it, was not there at the time, but it was called the Blessington lunula. It was on loan to a museum in Italy, so we didn't actually see it. But when there is another section in the British Museum that has quite a lot of things.
I'm going to stop you because we've had quite the discussion about how you pronounce this. And apparently it's lunula.
Lunula?
Is that right? No, somebody's shaking their head. I'm saying that wrong as well, apparently.
Yeah, I'm not sure. We'll call it a gold collar.
We'll call it the collar. The Blessington collar.
The Blessington collar. So there is a small section in the British Museum that has many things from Ireland there. There's croziers. There's, we'll call it a Tara brooch-like brooch, not as an ornate. Mm-hmm. There is a bell. There's a whole section. And all of these, you know, I can understand that the British Museum may hold some items that are in, say, in areas that there's conflict or whatever. But Ireland is a stable country. They should repatriate these items to Ireland. So I contacted the National Museum in Ireland about it. They were saying, oh, there's a process. You know what I mean? They weren't very, you know, accommodating. Mm-hmm. So, but if people go onto the British Museum website, there is every item that's on display there's photographs. And underneath, there's a section where you can email them about the particular artefact. So if everybody went on and emailed them and said, well, I emailed them this morning and said, can you please return this to Ireland? And I'm waiting for a response.
You again.
Well, so if you went into, say this lady was talking about an artifact from Swinford, you know, you could go on, see that on the website, and there's an email link, really just a box that you put in your details and email them. And if enough people did ask, they might start listening to us.
Hashtag it would be rude not to.
Yeah, that's indeed.
I'm sure they probably though say, you know, that there is an issue about ownership though, because I don't think there's no suggestion that they pillaged them or in any way took them under any.
That, yeah. You know, people bought them and they sold them on or whatever. But you know, that's a long time ago. And maybe they should just hand it back to a stable. But the lady was saying about in Swinford, that would be a massive centre for a, you know, a whole county museum could be built about that. The same with the Blessington one. A whole Wicklow museum could be built around the whole thing. You know, whereas it's just shut in a corner.
Gail. It's not on display at all, apparently. It wasn't on display
The thing is, they're the only things that we know that are on display. How many things do they have in boxes out the back that haven't seen the light of day for years?
That is actually a very good question, and that is what I would love to know. That a very, very good point, actually. What is there that has never maybe been displayed ever?
And was it recent? Was it one of the islands in the west of Ireland that they brought back skulls to recently? Was it that were in Trinity College for like over 100 years?
Yes.
And they were brought back to the island?
Yes.
So I think it's about time that, you know, the people of the country know that these things are going on. And I are over there. I contacted some local representatives, councillors in Wicklow about it, and they had zero interest. I said, you know, could you not start a campaign? You've more clout than me to get this back to Wicklow. And they were not impressed. They weren't interested at all, which I thought was very bad.
You are so right, though, because something like that, as you say, that is not even on display, particularly you look at Swinford, not even on display over there, it would be a massive tourist attraction.
Town in the west of Ireland,
exactly.
Or the small town in the east of Ireland, you could build a whole museum and that could be the centrepiece of it.
Absolutely, yeah. It would be. So, it would just mean so much more.
So Katie, you continue the campaign to get these artefacts back to Ireland. As I said, you've got more swing than, you know, the likes of us that are just ringing up.
Gail, thank you so much.
No problem. Thank you very much. Enjoy the long weekend.
You too. Hashtag, it would be rude not to. Michael O'Connor. Michael, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Katie.
Tell me about the Annals of Inishfallen.
Well, from a South Kerry man to a North Kerry woman, I couldn't let this go. I said, the Annals of Inishfallen were written in between the 4th century, I suppose, 5th century, depends on which book you read, and they're now stored in the Bodleian Library in Oxford in England. There were a journalist account wrote on this famous island in Loch Lane, the Lake of Learning, which is about a 20-acre site just about a mile out from Rosscastle. And I think, again, like all the others, it would be a major boost, actually, to the tourism product, especially in the west of Ireland and that. And there was moves afoot back in the day to get the annals back. Brian O'Leary, when he was a town councillor with the Killarney Urban Council, when we had urban councillors, tried very hard, actually, to get it back.
And where are they?
They're in the Bodleian Library in Oxford in England. There's a facsimile actually on the Bodleian Library. If you Google it deep enough, you can find about 120 odd pages, but actually on the website itself. And it's fascinating. It's a mix of old Irish and Latin writing. And it's no more than, they reckon it was started up in Emily, up in the Leash area, and came down then through the Midlands and onto Inishfallen. The account would have been a worldwide account up to the time of St. Patrick, and from St. Patrick on then, it concentrated mainly on Irish events and stuff like that. So like a journal, a big wind,
and
but there's a lot of history in it.
Was it monks who wrote it?
They were the first journalists. They were the chronicles of the period, really, I suppose, really. Like, they gave us lots of things. And, like, they were talking there about a crozier. There's also the famous Inishfallen crozier that was found on the River Lown, which drains the Killarney Lakes. Mm-hmm. That was found in 1867. Now, that's in the National Museum in Dublin. It's a fabulous piece of work as well, actually. And the island of Inishfallen is actually very interesting as well. It was founded by St. Finian, and he set up a leper colony there, actually. And there's a lovely Romanesque building there as well. And Thomas Moore, the poet, wrote about that when he wrote the poem that Heaven Reflects Killarney, he said, if Killarney was Heaven Reflects, that Inishfallon was actually heaven itself. So the whole thing would actually tie in quite well with Killarney House here in Gardens, which are fabulous asset to us. And the annuals would actually sit quite well there.
For and sure. But I suppose people might say, Michael, haven't you enough to be going on with in terms of tourist attractions in Killarney?
Well, I'll tell you something now. When you look, if Trinity College can find the students' union €214,000 for a couple of years of shutting down the Book of Kells.
A whole other day's work there now, Michael, for sure.
Yeah, but
on that
we
one.
Only got 10 or 15% of that as a revenue stream, like,
this,
you know.
This is what you're thinking. Tax, you're thinking of monetizing the annals of Inishfallon.
I suppose, haven't they all? But it would be a fascinating thing, I think, to have back. And, you know, it's part of our very, very rich heritage, you know.
Absolutely.
And it would be well worth actually making an effort. And I think maybe instead of maybe looking for the annals back, if we could make a list of all the things and maybe use diplomatic diplomacy or some diplomacy to get some of them back even on a loan for 5 months or a month of the tourist season to take them back again. You see, the annals were actually bought by an antiquarian book guy called Rawlinson, and he donated his library then to the Bodleian Library.
So that's how they ended up there. And have they been translated? Do we know what's in
them?
They
are translated, yeah. There are two editions were published, one in 1933, was published by it was edited by a guy called Best and Owen O'Neill in 1933, and the second edition then was translated by Sean McCaff in 1953. And again, the Manchester University, again digging deep, have a kind of the translations are actually up on their website as well for anybody that would be. No, it's not bedtime reading a book club stuff like this.
I don't think we'd be doing it in the book club. But no. I do think though that there is something to be said as well, that we should be grateful on one level that these institutions actually kept and minded and preserved these fantastic artifacts. Yeah. You know, I mean, that's a big part.
And they had the learning as well.
Like when we didn't have the means or the ways to be minding them.
Yeah. No. I mean, like,
but now we're saying, do you know what? That was grand. We want them back now.
But even Brian Boru was educated on Inishfallon.
At Inishfallon Island.
On Inishfallon Island. The next time you're in Killarney, you'll have to take a boat trip out there, which is absolutely fantastic. About 20 acres, nice walk around it as well. A bit kind of overgrazed now by the deer and that, but well worth a visit.
Definitely. That's definitely going on the list for the next time I'm down that way. Michael, thanks for that. I'm going to have to take a break. We'll be back in a moment.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
Joe Duffy!
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
Really, enough is enough now. Bring them back home. It would be rude not to. I'll have to put my thinking hat on. Yeah, you know, Thomas Crown, too.
That was Pierce Brosnan again saying, enough is enough, enough is enough. Mary Cahill, good afternoon to you.
Hello, Katie.
Retired now, but former keeper of the Irish Antiquities.
At the National Museum, yes.
At the National Museum. So the very woman we absolutely need to be talking to today. Talk to me about the fact that all these antiquities have ended up in British and presumably in other museums and galleries around the world. How did that happen?
Well, Katie, in the 19th century in Ireland, there was no state-sponsored National Museum or anything of that sort. There was a museum in the Royal Irish Academy, but their resources were very limited and they could only acquire so many objects. A lot of material was being found at the time because of the way that land was worked at that time. So private collectors kind of filled the gap. But nonetheless, an awful lot of material that was found, especially gold and silver, was actually melted down for recycling and remade into jewellery.
Was it?
And I could tell you stories about a jeweller, watch clockmaker and dentist from my own hometown in Clonmel who threatened to cut up a beautiful late Bronze Age dress fastener and use it to fill the teeth of his patients in Clonmel. So there are many stories of the loss of artefacts during this period. But in fact, what it all boils down to in many cases is that Irish collectors choose of their own free will to sell their collections at auction in London, either during their lifetimes or they were sold by their families after their deaths. I could give you the case of Redmond Anthony, a wonderful collector and antiquarian from Piltown in County Kilkenny, who actually had a private museum which he opened to the public at a shilling per visit, and all of the money went to support the Carrick on Shore Fever Hospital, which was just a few miles down the road. After his death, though, in 1848, one of his sons, who was living in London, sold all the gold in his collection to the British Museum, and the rest of his collection went up for auction in London shortly after that. There are many other examples that I could give you throughout the 19th century. Indeed, one of those people was Sir Thomas Tobin of Ballincollig Powder Mills in County Cork, and he had in his collection another beautiful lunula from Mangerton in County Kerry. That is also in the British Museum to this day. And
so there was no legislation around, well, of course, we didn't have our own, this is pre-independence, a lot of this stuff, but when did legislation, or when did you know, rules come in around what could or could not be traded or passed on?
Well, at the time there was the custom of treasure trove, whereby the Crown could claim gold and silver found in certain circumstances, but that was really ignored in Ireland for a great deal of the 19th century. Eventually, a treasure trove minute was introduced, which allowed the Royal Irish Academy to acquire gold and silver on behalf of the Crown, but to hold it here in Ireland. Before that, anybody in possession of objects, however they came into their possession, that's another story that could keep me here on the phone to you quite a while. It was a free market, and London, no more than New York or Geneva in terms of art today, London was seen as a place where you would maximise your asset, basically. And in terms of those English collectors whose material, including Irish artefacts, ended up in the British Museum, very often it was Irish collectors who were sharing their information and sharing their collections. They would exchange things. If you had two of a certain type of artefact, I might exchange something else that I had two of, so that your collection would have one of each, if you know what I mean. So as late as 1913, Robert Day, who was a very well-known and famous antiquarian and collector in Cork, he sold a huge collection of Irish antiquities, but also including some foreign material, which he also collected at Sotheby's in London in 1913. And that collection has been essentially scattered to the four winds. The National Museum did its level best to buy as much as it could at the time within as the funds allowed. The Ulster Museum bought material there, but quite a lot of that collection has ended up in the United States, for example. And during my time as a curator in the National Museum, whenever the opportunity presented itself, as it often did, again, coming up at auction in London, things from the Day collection or indeed from other collections, we always tried our level best to get them and to bring them back.
And tell me, just in terms of, like they say, we heard about the Swinford Torque, or, you know, Gail was talking about other artefacts, and saying, you know, there may well be, you know, artefacts that we would feel were hugely, hugely important to various places around Ireland that may not even be on display, you know, because obviously the British Museum has such a massive collection. Is there any chance of us getting any of those back, bringing them home?
Well, I can say, Katie, that we have the most friendly and colleagues relations with the British Museum, with our colleagues in the Antiquities Department. We have had material of Irish origin on display in the gold exhibition in Kildare Street. It's not there at the moment. We had it for a certain period of time. Just a few years ago, some of the collection of Redmond Anthony was lent to the Waterford Treasures Museum at the request of the curator, Amy McEnany, at that time. So the British Museum and other museums in Britain, and indeed other places around the world which have Irish collections, are more than open to requests for loans for exhibition. And it all depends on having a suitable location.
And I presume security. Security is a huge issue, isn't it?
Of course. When I say suitable location, I mean a county museum. And unfortunately, that's something that Mayo doesn't have. It's something Roscommon doesn't have. Kerry is lucky. It has its county museum in Tralee.
We still don't have the annals of Inis Fallon, though.
No, but if they put in the request to the Bodleian, I'm sure that they would probably get a positive response. I should say to you, Katie, just out of interest, that the Mangerton Lunula, the Blessington Lunula, that's another question. I doubt very much it's got anything to do with Blessington. There's no evidence at all to suggest that.
Oh,
it was
really?
Well, funny, dodgy little things went on in the 19th century as well, and very often objects were said to be from certain places that were associated with other things that, again, might make them
more valuable,
seem more important or more valuable. And right. Wicklow, of course, was known for its gold mines, but prehistoric gold is not a big thing in Wicklow, not at all. Nice. But I think it would really help if the people who are on to you about, who are interested in getting things back to their own locations, if they would go to their local representatives, and I believe there are elections coming up, and insist that their county needs a county museum, and then they will have a suitable venue, they will have the curator in place, they will be able to make those requests both to the National Museum and to the British Museum and any other museum that is holding material from that area. Oh, okay. And get them back there.
That's the campaign, county museum campaign. That's the one we can get behind. Okay, yeah. That's what we should be calling for. Well, Gail was saying the local reps she went to had showing no interest at all in her efforts to bring artefacts home. But maybe she's asking the wrong question, as you say there, Mary.
Maybe she is. And can I just tell you one other thing? Katie, this is really of interest to me anyway, as an archaeologist working in this period. There is an Irish Lunula in Cornwall, which has been there since at least 2000 BC. It's an ancient import into Cornwall. So I don't think we'd be asking for that anytime soon. There are Irish artefacts taken out of the country by the Vikings, which are in Norway. I'm not sure we'd be asking for those back either.
Well, sure, why not? Why don't we throw in the question? You never know. You never know, Mary. You never, a dumb priest never got a parish.
No, they're complicated issues. They're all bound up with our history. And I think it's really important that we do understand. The British Museum is the museum that's always mentioned in these affairs. But the British Museum wasn't here in Ireland looking to acquire these objects at all. It wasn't excavation sites in the country. It's quite different when we talk about maybe objects from Egypt or objects such as the Benin bronzes. They are in a different
We're talking about pillaging versus buying and being donated to. They're very different.
We're talking about largely our own ancestors selling our objects in London for their benefit.
Apart from the Norway ones, because they definitely were pillaged. So Mary, I have to go. I have a couple of more calls to try and get to, and I have to get another break in. But many thanks for that. Really, really, really interesting stuff.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
Joe Duffy.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
Now, we were talking to the former Keeper of Irish Antiquities in the National Museum there before the break, and I'm delighted to say now we have Pat Wallace on the line. Pat, good afternoon.
Hi, Katie.
Yeah, Pat, people will know you, of course, former director of the National Museum. Where do you stand now on this, it would be rude not to bring them home?
Oh, no, I stand 100% with my distinguished colleague, Mary Cahill. I would even go stronger than Mary. I think it's wrong to be clamoring to bring things home. These objects are in legitimate, world-class institutions with conservation departments and proper security, in brackets, like the British Museum. So we have excelled. I'm out of the museum, as is Mary, for a long time. But we have excellent connections with the museum network all over Europe and America. So things are safe once they're in a legitimate state-sponsored museum, and to clamour for their return. I mean, their return is to bring them back, which is a legitimate aspiration in a certain way. But they must be placed in cultural context. I would far better see the information about the artifacts we're discussing infiltrating into school books and into popular television programs, rather than just clamoring for something that won't be fully explained, understood, appreciated, contexted.
Hang on a minute, though. Would the National Museum not be a safe, secure place for these artefacts to be placed in?
It is the state.
Yeah. So why not want them called for them to be brought back and placed there?
But why do that? I mean, the National Museum has enough on its hand. It hasn't published and made known even its collections as it stands. So why add to that burden when our curators can use photographs and up-to-date research from parallel institutions that are mining the stuff?
But if I'm from Swinford, Pat, if I'm from Swinford, I'll want to see the Swinford Torque in my National Museum, not to be going over to London to be told that it's in the storage somewhere over there.
Well, I in regard to that item, I think if the National Museum, if there was a strong local desire to have it in County Mayo, then the National Museum, very fortunately, thanks largely to Enby Kenny, by the way, the National Museum has a branch in Castlebar, so it could be displayed there. But where in Swinford, Katie, are you saying it should go? These things are sacred and deserving of the utter study and protection and preservation and conservation. They're not to be played around with like pawns or trinkets. These are serious items of world culture. And, you know, for instance, I'm a native of County Limerick. Why should the people of Arda demand the Arda chalice back to the village of Arda? Not at all. How could they? And how could they take on the burden of such an item? And why would people not be happy with an item of world importance like the Arda chalice being in the National Museum of Ireland, our capital city?
But isn't that a good example of it? If that Arda chalice was in the British Museum and we were told, isn't it well minded there and secure there? I don't think people would be too happy about that either.
They wouldn't the director of the day would be making a case to get it back, and he or she would be supported by the Minister for Education or Minister for Arts and the Taoiseach to get it back. But that applies perhaps in the case of the Emly Shrine and some other items that Mary Cahill mentioned. But that has to be done at museum level and with proper thought out positions on all sides. I mean, I'm not running down Swinford, and in fact, Swinford's a very important place. But there is no county museum, as Mary said, in Mayo. There is also, but we do have a branch of the National Museum in County Mayo, the only county outside of Dublin where there is a branch. So there would be a case for a Mayo return, but not to the villages of the town of Swinford.
Okay, Pat. Okay, we're over time. Thank you for that. Really great talking to you. Really interesting subject, isn't it? But that's it for the weekend. For the long weekend, everyone out there, enjoy the long weekend. On sound today, we had James Feeney. Broadcast coordinator today was Shane Galvin. Our producer is Hilary Jones. The series producer, of course, is Annette Egan. As I say, enjoy the long weekend. Stand by for Ray.
Liveline on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Harry Curry. Elevate your bedroom with our fresh new bedding designs and colours, in-store and online at harrycurry.com.
0818 715 815 stays open until 3:15 p.m. or email joe@rte.ie.